Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. We'll head to Ukraine shortly, but coming up we speak to the American endurance athlete Lael Wilcox, who's claimed a new world record as the fastest woman to cycle around the globe.
I'm so excited. I had so much fun out there, and I think I'm just still running off all that energy. So there's always going to be a high moment and a low moment in every day. And then just kind of making it to the next one kept me going.
More on that in about 20 minutes here on NewsHour. A Russian strike on Red Cross vehicles in the east of Ukraine has killed three aid workers, according to President Zelensky, who called it a war crime. The attack happened in a village a dozen kilometres away from the front line in Donetsk. The Red Cross said its team had been preparing to distribute fuel to vulnerable households ready for the winter. Two other of its team members were injured. Our correspondent James Waterhouse in Kyiv has been telling me more.
We are trying to stitch this together, but President Zelensky posted a picture appearing to show a white ICRC lorry. You could see the Red Cross on the side. It was on fire. There were crates at the back. And what the organization is saying is that these are teams that regularly operate in the area. They were in a village north of the occupied city of Donetsk. This is somewhere very close to the front line, somewhere very dangerous. And they were giving out wood and coal briquettes, you know, the type you would see in a barbecue, to people there ahead of what is going to be a difficult winter, with the country's infrastructure continuing to be targeted. And what they're saying is that a group of vehicles came under artillery fire, where three Ukrainian team members lost their lives and two other people were injured. Incidents like these are rare. You know, there was an international food kitchen vehicle that was hit in July. There were no casualties then. But despite the very real dangers, where you have drones overhead, where you have the constant threat of missile and artillery strikes, humanitarian teams are rare, sort of rarely come into harm's way. But it's also a reminder of the very real risks they take because of how regular they head to these kind of areas.
Is there a definitive answer as to who's responsible?
It's very difficult to pin this down. President Zelensky, as I say, has called this another Russian war crime. It's clear in his mind. The ICRC won't be drawn on this. They see that as a sort of crucial tenet of their presence as a humanitarian organization. But if you look at the fact that it is often Russia that habitually targets Ukrainian-controlled territory with artillery strikes, sometimes they are targeted, you know, because of drone reconnaissance, for example. They are able to hit moving vehicles. There have been teams of journalists who've been targeted in this way in the past. But equally, we see indiscriminate Russian attacks time after time on residential areas. I don't think we will ever know for sure what the motive was, whether this was deliberate. And thus far, we've had no kind of acknowledgement by the Kremlin. But at the very least, this is a very difficult, tragic day for the teams concerned.
The British Prime Minister is heading to Washington tomorrow for talks with President Biden. What are the chances that the Allies will permit the use of long-range missiles into Russia, as Mr. Zelensky so much hopes?
Well, if we look at the direction of travel, if we look at President Biden a few days ago saying, look, well, that is something we are working on, I would not be surprised if there was a further lifting of restrictions, because we have time after time seen Western confidence grow. We've seen restrictions on Ukraine at one point on targeting anything inside Russia. That's now been lifted on Russian targets close to the border, sites that might be used in its invasion of Ukraine. Clearly, we could see a further relaxation, but it's not going to suddenly mean that, you know, Western-supplied missiles like HIMARS, for example, are going to be striking targets inside or close to Moscow, for example. However, Ukraine really does still see itself as fighting with one hand behind its back, not least when you see glide bombs land, launched from Russian fighter jets, you know, the best part of 100 kilometres inside Russia, and they're powerless to stop them. So Ukraine will push for it. And I would not be surprised if, off the back of Prime Minister Keir Starmer and President Biden, we might see a further announcement. That's certainly the political direction of travel we're seeing.
The BBC's James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Speaking to a reporter from Russian state television earlier, President Putin has warned that if the West allows Ukraine to fire long-range missiles at targets inside Russia, it will bring them into direct conflict with Moscow. After a contentious all-night debate, Mexican politicians have approved a controversial move to make judges elected by popular vote. Critics have rounded on the loss of independence in the judicial system of a country of more than 130 million people. The president of Mexico's Supreme Court says she's pessimistic about her country's future, but the reform was approved by two-thirds of Mexico's senators. It was promoted by the outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who said it would set an example to the rest of the world. In chaotic scenes, hundreds of protesters managed to storm the Senate, meaning the approval had to come in two votes. That was the sound of protesters breaking through the doors of the chamber and shouting, "Yes, we can." I've been speaking to Mario Miguel Carrillo, a federal congressman from Mexico's governing party, Morena, who supports today's change. He told me why.
These reforms democratize the judicial power in Mexico. So we are arranged in three powers, which is the executive, it's the president of the republic, then the legislative power, and then the judicial power. And you get the people to elect the ones in the executive and legislative. And with these changes in the law, people are going to be able to vote for all judges in Mexico.
You'll be aware that most people do view it as a central feature of democracy to have an independent judiciary.
Well, the thing is, right now, it's a promotion system in the judicial power in Mexico. And that is not democratic at all. And that allows corruption or partial decisions in the justice system in our country. So we are allowing the people to elect the better ones so they can decide their sentences, not bias because of the promotion system, but because of really impartial justice.
If Mexico has a problem with its judiciary, surely the problem lies with the prosecutors, not the judges. In 2022, only about 10% of prosecutors' investigations even made it before a judge.
Yes, of course. So right now, what we want to do is change the judicial system. And then in a second attempt, we're going to change the whole justice system, which includes the prosecutors.
Some opponents of this reform say that actually it has nothing to do with corruption or impunity. It's revenge from the outgoing president because the Supreme Court blocked many of his policies that he tried to introduce. What do you say to that?
Well, those voices that claim this, it's the one that right now are the beneficiary of the decisions of the Supreme Court. And they're going to lose all this privilege and all the power into the actual system. And that's why they are this kind of concern. But that's just false. It's not a vendetta. It's not a vengeance. It's to give the power to the people.
Let me quote the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Ken Salazar. He says that having elected judges is a major risk to the functioning of Mexican democracy. What do you say?
Yes. Well, Ambassador Ken Salazar is from the state of Colorado. And Colorado reaffirmed their judges through an electoral ballot. So if he does not agree with the system of the elections, well, he has the chance to submit that concern in his own state, Colorado.
That was Mario Miguel Carrillo, federal congressman from Mexico's governing party. Well, the United Nations Special Rapporteur for the Independence of Judges has written to the Mexican government with a formal objection to today's reform. Margaret Satterthwaite is also a professor of clinical law at New York University's School of Law. I asked her what her concerns were with this overhaul.
So my concerns involve specifically the way that these reforms will take Mexico away from its human rights obligations. So very specifically, everyone in Mexico has a human right to an impartial and independent justice system. And one of the main ways that we ensure that any justice system is impartial and independent is to select judges for their capacity, their training, and also their honorability, their ethical capacity. And moving the appointment process away from a focus on the merits and toward a system in which candidates will have to essentially compete in a political process will really make the system depart from that crucial requirement of independence and impartiality.
Well, you might have heard that congressman arguing that the appointment system is corrupt anyway, as it is. And Mexico has a big problem with corruption. Arguably, an electoral system creates greater accountability. It has that potential, surely.
Well, so I think it's important to think about accountability in what sense. So accountability is extremely important in any government system, and certainly for judges, accountability is very important. But the democratic legitimacy and accountability that judges get is by being beholden to nothing but the law. So the Constitution and the law is what judges are loyal to. And in that way, they're democratically accountable. And of course, they do have ethical rules, rules against corruption. And there's no question that those rules have to be assiduously complied with. And if they're not, if that's not happening in Mexico, the fix for that is really to ensure compliance. I do not think that this kind of thoroughgoing reform where the entire judicial system will be replaced would be an effective anti-corruption measure.
The reform also allows cases involving organized crime to be heard by anonymous, faceless judges. Surely that will empower judges to do their job without fear of retribution from organized crime.
So the issue of judges needing protection from organized crime is absolutely essential, and it is, in fact, crucial to their independence to make sure that they don't have that fear. Putting faceless judges on benches, however, is not something that has ever worked, and it has been actually discredited under human rights law. It's a real problem. It creates certain kinds of problems with transparency, problems with accountability of its own. So I don't see that as an effective measure. There are other kinds of measures that need to be taken in terms of ensuring security for judges.
You raised your concerns back in July to the Mexican government. Has the outgoing president reassured you in any way?
So the government has not replied to my letter. I do hope to get a response, but so far I haven't gotten anything.
That was Margaret Satterthwaite, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers. You're with the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Coming up, the World Health Organization says it's confident of the success of the first part of a massive polio vaccination drive in Gaza. We'll hear from one of the doctors delivering it.
At the moment, we are doing what we can to ensure the safety of our international and national staffs. But as a first responder all over the world, I think we are used to certain security issues. This has been not easy, but we are managing.
More on that in 30 minutes. The headlines: President Putin has warned that if the West allows Ukraine to fire long-range missiles at targets inside Russia, it will bring them into direct conflict with Moscow. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour from the BBC. The family of the jailed Belarusian opposition leader Maria Kolesnikova say they fear that she's being slowly killed in prison with insufficient food and extreme isolation. She's been held in solitary confinement for 18 months as extra punishment on top of an 11-year prison sentence for leading protests against the president in 2020. The news of the activist's plight came as the authoritarian leader of Belarus began a surprise release of other political prisoners, leading some to wonder whether he's signalling to Western governments that he wants to reduce his own political isolation. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
On March 10th, 2023, she was pushed in a punishment cell in total isolation.
Tatiana is desperately worried about her sister.
It's an even more horrible punishment cell.
Maria Kolesnikova was locked up for leading peaceful mass protests in Belarus in 2020. Crowds rallying against an election rigged to return Alexander Lukashenko to power. But the activist is being punished further in prison. Kept in isolation for 18 months now. No visits, no letters, no calls, and increasing concerns for her health.
What we hear, she's starving in the colony. Her illness requires a diet. She basically cannot eat what the food they provide in the colony. I believe that she already passed such a critical weight loss that endangers her life. I think that any means should be used to save her.
Just walking through this pedestrian area of central Warsaw, and people in the coffee shops here, the vast majority of them are speaking Russian. A lot of them are from Belarus. A lot of them took part in those protests in 2020 and left so they didn't get arrested.
For Dmitry Luksha, this city is now home. The journalist spent 28 months locked up. His only crime was to report on the opposition protests and then on his country's complicity in the war on Ukraine. In one prison camp, he worked breaking rocks alongside men convicted of murder and drug smuggling. But he tells me up to 30% of the inmates were there for their politics. You can spot them by the yellow tags they have stitched on their chests. This summer, though, Dmitry was suddenly pardoned by Alexander Lukashenko. He is one of about 80 political prisoners released so far in a series of surprise amnesties.
Maybe those who started the process, the arrests, realised they went too far. I don't know, but it's such a moment of joy to be home. The main thing is that this process is happening, and for it not to stop.
State media are presenting the pardons as proof of a caring, humane leader. There's another election due next year, so it is possible Lukashenko's looking to soften his image. Others think he's signalling to the West that he wants to engage. The chances of big-name prisoners like Maria Kolesnikova getting out look slim. Dmitry thinks about Maria Kolesnikova a lot. She became hugely popular during the 2020 protests. But Dmitry knows how in prison, political detainees are singled out for extra punishment. And even though he's out now, he admits he jumps at every noise, terrified the police are coming for him again to lock him up again. You understand that you've done nothing wrong and they shouldn't be coming for you. But you can't tell your heart that, Dmitry says. It is the brutal Belarus of today. And your heart is afraid.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reporting. Now, an American ultra-endurance cyclist yesterday claimed a new world record as the fastest woman to travel around the globe by bike. Lael Wilcox crossed 21 countries on four continents before arriving back in Chicago in the US 108 days after having set off. Her friends and family were there to cheer her when she arrived back. Lael's journey of more than 29,000 kilometres shaved 16 days off the previous women's world record. Earlier I spoke to Lael, who's now back in Chicago. I asked her how she was feeling.
I'm so excited. I had so much fun out there, and I think I'm just still running off all that energy.
Tell me about the route, because obviously you can't cycle around the globe without going on some boats and trains and planes. I don't know. I mean, how did you circumnavigate the globe exactly? Didn't you get a flight to Portugal at one stage?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started in Chicago. The first stretch was to New York City and then flew from there to Portugal, then crossing Europe, across Turkey to Georgia, flew to Australia, across Australia, then to New Zealand, took the ferry to the North Island, and then from there flew to Alaska, and then south again through Canada, the west coast of the U.S., and then up the Route 66 back to Chicago.
Wow, what a trip. Presumably, if you do a requisite number of kilometers on land, then that fits within the record attempt, does it?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a list of rules. It's a minimum of 29,000 kilometers. You have to either ride east or west, crossing two opposite sides of the globe. So for me, that was Spain and New Zealand. And then you can't quite zigzag. So going one direction or another.
Does it remove some of the fun that you can never relax, that you can never be a tourist?
Oh, I mean, I felt like I was a tourist the whole time. You know, from the bike, it's like it's such a good pace to see the world and experience everything. I spent so much time outside, and I actually invited people from all over the world to come ride with me. So I got to meet thousands of people on bikes along the way, and sometimes they'd come for 5 minutes or sometimes they'd stay for the whole day. And it was such a fun way to share the adventure.
Well, they clearly didn't slow you down. Tell me about some of the highs and lows of the journey.
Oh, man. So, I mean, I rode through winter in Australia and New Zealand. So even seeing some snow in New Zealand, and it was pretty cold and pretty dark. But there were such kind people there, even folks coming out in the dark just to cheer me on. I had so many good days out there. Sometimes it felt like I'd never make it. But 3.5 months later, I was back to where I started.
You see a lot of nature up close. Tell me about that.
Oh, I sure do. So many animals, bears in Canada and kangaroos and wombats and deer. And I even ran over a groundhog. And I
did it
rode
survive?
Every time. It did. And I didn't crash.
Well done.
So that was a win.
And tell me, how do you maintain morale? There must have been down moments.
Yeah, you know, honestly, sometimes I'd feel like, oh, I just wish I could ride faster right now, or I wish I didn't have such a strong headwind. But with this kind of ride, everything's always changing. So there's always going to be a high moment and a low moment in every day. And then just kind of making it to the next one kept me going.
Did you think you'd break the record?
I really hoped I would. I set a goal for myself of 110 days, but it's so hard to know if that's even possible from the outset. But I stayed really disciplined to trying to achieve, you know, about just under 300 kilometers per day. And I knew if I could do that, I would break the overall record.
And she did. Congratulations to American ultra-endurance cyclist Lael Wilcox, speaking to me from Chicago. This is the BBC World Service, live from London, NewsHour.
And spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, in Malawi in southeastern Africa, extreme weather patterns are pushing farmers to experiment with new ways of using their harvest. Some of them are now turning overripe bananas that would otherwise go to waste into something unexpected, wine. Anne Okumu has this report.
Emily is clearing weed from her once thriving banana plantation. A severe heat wave has turned most of her harvest into scorched soil and dried up leaves.
It is sad that we have to go through all this waste. The heat here is unbearable. All our hard work and investment is lost.
Extreme weather events in Karonga District, northern Malawi, have become more frequent. Farmers here face a challenging mix of harsh heat and intense rain. Emily relocated her farm from the shores of Lake Malawi to higher grounds to protect her land from flooding. But now, searing temperatures have made farming nearly impossible.
Some of the bananas fell off their branches. Some you can't even see where we planted. Down at the old farm, our challenge was loads of water from the lake. Up here, we have way too much heat from the sun. All this makes our bananas ripen very fast and go to waste.
So instead of throwing away overripe bananas, Emily and her colleagues have put them to better use. They use overripe bananas to make wine. Bananas are selected, peeled, sweetened and doused in yeast and lemons to preserve taste. They are then fermented to make wine. Tennyson Gondwe is the CEO of Comsip Cooperative Union, which has been helping women venture into this business.
There was quite a lot of problems for the farmers to transition from banana as a subsistence crop to winemaking. To maintain quality and taste of the banana wine, that's why we are saying we have invested very much in capacity building to train them on how to have quality production and also to maintain the taste. That's why we also had our colleagues in Malawi Bureau of Standards, which is trying to certify. We have also assisted them with the equipment for them to measure the quality and the alcoholic content of the banana wine.
Vineyards that rely on stable climates are threatened by the unpredictability of climate change. So, could bananas replace grapes for winemaking? What is for sure now is that banana wine has proved a success in neighboring markets in Tanzania and Rwanda. But what about here in Malawi? Back at the farm, winemakers have a taste of their labor.
This is very sweet wine. You need to be seated to enjoy the flavors.
Adapting to climate change is a tough challenge for farmers around the world. But as the farming community in this part of Malawi can testify, there can be alternative solutions. As the say almost goes, if life gives you overripe bananas, make wine.
Anne Okumu reporting from Malawi in southeastern Africa. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, an American billionaire on board the SpaceX Polaris Dawn mission at the moment has carried out the first ever privately funded spacewalk more than 700 kilometres above the Earth. This is the moment Jared Isaacman, whose money is behind the mission, opened the capsule hatch and moved out of the spacecraft.
Earth sure looks like a perfect world.
You can just about hear him there saying, "Earth sure looks like a perfect world," followed by cheering from the control room. As he moved outside the spacecraft, he was also exposing all four crew members to the vacuum that is space. Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Hina Khan, a space scientist and former NASA researcher. She agreed that spacewalking was a fairly loose description here.
Yes, exactly. I think if you say spacewalk to somebody, they have visions of perhaps a movie of people being outside a capsule and running, you know, kind of walking across, being tethered to a structure. What happened here was it's a fairly small capsule within which the four astronauts are located. And they, as you say, opened the hatch of that capsule and thus making the entire space in a vacuum. And then they had a ladder, which they you then, Jared, then walked up and then kind of looked out, peeked out a little bit, but then extended into space to test out the kind of motions of and some of the capabilities of the suit. So not an untethered, you know, a tethered walk out into the opens and space, but still a space walk nonetheless.
A sort of space stand, really. Now, SpaceX is working in collaboration with NASA on this, and they're sharing findings, scientific findings. Does it bother you, though, that those on board aren't technically scientists?
Well, so, I mean, I think you're right. This is a collaborative endeavour here where it's been funded, as you absolutely said, by an individual, and he's paid for the activity and his position to be in this programme. But there are two engineers on the mission as well, employees of SpaceX itself, and they are there to really give the backing of the scientific element of research that is really, really needed. And the reason that it's a collaborative approach is, you know, NASA are really putting forward their ambition on human spaceflight exploration in terms of going back to the moon or further afield in terms of going to Mars. And in order to do that, they really have to gather as much information and data as they can to understand not just the human physiology in these really extreme environments, but any equipment or suits or structures that they want to take into space. How will they fare? And so this gives an opportunity to have, you know, fairly, you know, wealthy individuals who feel like they want to go into the outness, the vastness of space, but also to be able to provide that environment and that mechanism that allows them, scientists, to move forward in their own endeavours.
And do you approve of wealthy individuals footing the bills and not taxpayers, briefly?
Well, I mean, they have the money to spare, and if that's what they want to spend their money, then I think there's advantages all round. I mean, like I say, it's a collaborative approach. I think the other thing that gives it lets people see is that, you know, if you are part of an industry, then there is the possibility that the two individuals, like I say, I think one of them started as an intern at SpaceX, and now they are in a space capsule orbiting above our head. So I think there's opportunity there. How we decide that we want to furnish this as we go forward, I think, is always going to be debatable, but I think it opens up that opportunity.
Dr. Hina Khan, space scientist, former NASA researcher. Now, the head of the American Armed Forces in Africa, General Michael Langley, has told the BBC that the US military will only cooperate with countries in the Sahel once they return to democracy. American and other Western forces have continued to withdraw from Burkina Faso, Mali, Chad, and more recently Niger, as the leaders of those African countries pivot towards Russia in their fight against expansionist jihadi forces. General Langley blamed the souring of relations which resulted in the drawdown of troops on a campaign of Russian disinformation. He was speaking in Nairobi to the BBC's Anne Soy, who began by asking him how the US military was now redefining its relationship with the Sahel.
When we define that, they have to have our core values. They have to have the core values of democratic norms, you know, and respect for human rights. All the things that are core values that are codified within a responsible governance for the people across civil society, protections of rights and freedoms.
You're saying that your re-engagement with the countries in the Sahel is premised on a return to democracy. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. We are still engaged with them, but, you know, it's in a diplomatic vein right now as far as how much we can do because, you know, there's a number of restrictions and sanctions with limits what we can do as far as security cooperation.
What you're saying generally is that you cannot exist side by side with some of these new partners that those countries have chosen.
They don't have the same values. There's ways that we can still engage with that country itself, but no, we will not have side-by-side operations with them because they don't have the same values that we have, the law of armed conflict. That's just some of the things that, you know, watch groups are saying from when it was Wagner that they're in true violation of that, allegedly.
When you look at Niger, for instance, you had huge investments there, Airbase 201, built at a cost of over $100 million. That's a major loss for you, isn't it?
Well, we look at it from a perspective. One, it's informed by the threat as far as our posture across West Africa. You do have a growing violent extremist organization threat. And it's metastasized across these countries that has affected Mali, that has affected Burkina Faso and Niger. So we look at it holistically, that we're still going to engage across West Africa with like-minded countries and some of the coastal West Africa countries to be able to help these countries defeat terrorism in that vein. Not just terrorism, but there's transnational crime organizations that are destabilizing as well.
And that's just the reason this military junta gave for asking your forces and the allied forces to leave, because they said despite being on the ground, the extremism continued to spread across the country. The jihadists continued to gain more territory. What's your assessment of the accomplishments of your forces when they were in the Sahelian region dealing with extremism?
And let me address some of the drivers of that instability. You know, back in 2008, across the Sahel or on the African continent, violent extremist organizations, especially Islamic extremism, was of the global percentage, 4%. Now it's 40%. Now these countries that don't have the security construct to defeat it, Russian disinformation primarily across the Sahel, gave them the scapegoat and said it was the West. So we're looking and listening. They say, hey, we don't want your boots on the ground. However, we do need some help in some areas. So across some of the domains that operationalize will help them build capacity to fight terrorism. But they also are coming at this problem set with a whole of government approach.
That was the head of the American Armed Forces in Africa, General Michael Langley, speaking to the BBC's Anne Soy. Lee Miller was a Vogue model and a trailblazing photographer during the Second World War who went to the front line and defied expectations of her sex. She captured harrowing and important images from the liberation of concentration camps and was famously photographed in Hitler's bathtub in his apartment in Munich after his death. Now her life is being captured in a new film called Lee, and she's played by the British actor Kate Winslet. The BBC's Emma Barnett spoke to Kate.
The reason I wanted to make the film was because I wanted to lift her out of the male gaze. You know, when I first started Googling Lee Miller, I knew a bit about her, sure. I had a couple of books about her. I had books that included photographs of her as a model. But I did not know this Lee. I really didn't. But these labels that existed even then, and they exist for women still now, Lee was described in a sort of almost infantilizing way. And I thought, hang on a minute, hang on. That was a sliver of her life in her 20s. She lived a whole life way beyond that time. And she hated being a model. She always said, I'd rather take a picture than be one.
It's quite a journey, isn't it, to go from, you know, being the subject in that way to, you know, what she ended up photographing, the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau, you know, the front lines of the absolute most, you know, unimaginable horrors of World War II.
Yeah. And I'm sure she didn't know what to expect. I don't think she was naive. I think Lee Miller was born with her eyes wide open. Who of any of us, of anyone who witnessed the atrocities of the Nazi regime, who could ever have known what they were to be met with when they walked through the gates of Dachau or Auschwitz? Who could possibly have known? But what Lee did do that sets her photography apart was not to photograph the soldiers and the bloodshed and the actual fighting. She didn't do that. But Lee was in a position where she could follow her nose, and she'd spent her life being extremely good at that and being very instinctive and also being extremely restless. And she talked about that, you know, oh, I'd stay here much longer if it weren't for my damn itchy bottom, she would say. And that's how she would describe this sort of restlessness in her that even she herself couldn't really understand.
One of the photos that is very famous of her at this time, as opposed to when she was a model, I just wanted to understand from you how you read into it, how you spoke about it with her son, which is her decision to get into Hitler's bathtub and be photographed. What's going on there?
Listen, At that stage of things, they had not changed their clothes for 6 weeks. This is true. They hadn't changed their clothes for 6 weeks and they hadn't touched hot water for 6 weeks. So she drove to Prinzregentenplatz, which is the address where his apartment is, and there was a guy on the door keeping guard, and Lee, using her wiles, would have bribed him with a carton of cigarettes or half a bottle of brandy. She was very, very good at finding the things that she really needed to keep her going. And she made her way in. And it's true that when they got into the apartment, there was an entire regiment in there having a party. And then they discovered there was a bathroom. And there are many photographs of other people using that bathroom, you know, soldiers, GIs having a shave. I myself can perfectly well see how, as a woman in that situation where she hadn't had any clean knickers for 6 weeks, I think there was something in her that just thought, well, it would be logical to take a bath. And we decided that once she was in that bath, then she realized this is a photograph that no one else is going to get or even think of.
That was the actor Kate Winslet talking to Emma Barnett about her latest film, Lee. Here with the BBC World Service live from London, this is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. In Gaza now, the World Health Organization says it's confident that the first part of a massive polio vaccination drive has hit its target of reaching more than 90% of children there under 10. Today, the organization also succeeded in getting almost 100 people, many of them children, out of Gaza for medical treatment abroad. Many thousands are still in desperate medical need of being removed from Gaza. Dr. Mohammed Hamid is the medical director of the International Medical Corps Field Hospital in Deir al-Bala in the central Gaza Strip. His organization works in partnership with the WHO to deliver the polio vaccine campaign. I asked him how difficult it was to operate in a war zone.
For sure, it's very difficult in terms of the uncertainty related to the supplies, how they enter to the Gaza Strip, and as well the living conditions that for the mass displaced populations in Gaza itself. So the first phase is already finishing, and we will start with the second dose in the second phase. That will happen on the 21st of September of this month. With the experience we have in the first phase, we are ready to implement. We think it will be more smoother learning from what happened in the first phase.
Clearly, this hasn't been a complete ceasefire recently. You'll know that six staff members of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a refugee camp in central Gaza. You must have been acutely aware of the dangers.
Definitely, at the moment, we are doing what we can to ensure the safety of our international and national staffs. But as a first responder all over the world, I think we are used to certain security issues. This has been not easy, but we are managing.
100 people who needed medical treatment outside Gaza were evacuated to the UAE. It's a start, but much more is needed, isn't it?
Correct. What I was aware of before the October 7th, I think there was a big number of evacuation happening every year, around 22,000 going outside Gaza. And this has been limited so far. We are also participating in ensuring that patient in need has been also treated. And those who are need medical evacuation outside, we also refer them to the channels with our partnership with the WHO.
On the polio vaccination, tell us about the children that you immunized. What kind of condition were they in? What signs were there of difficult life recently, of starvation even?
We see daily around 1,300 patients. 40% of them are children. And among those children, we see for sure more diseases related to the water and sanitation issues, skin diseases as high agenda because of the overcrowdedness. We see a lot of upper respiratory tract infections. And as well, we see some of the immunopreventive diseases. There was an outbreak also of hepatitis A on the area, diarrheal diseases. So the same children who are getting vaccination, I think they're coming with that. We see a rise on the malnutrition compared to the past. especially among children under five and the pregnant lactating woman, and this for sure can continue. So basically, this is a situation where we see the children in our clinics.
You're talking as if it was any other job. It must have been quite traumatic, actually, for the staff who had to carry out this immunization. Difficult.
Definitely, for our staff as well. They are part of the displaced population. They live in tents. I admire the work they are doing, and they have their families, their relatives. They lost some of them. It's a complex and a tough working situation for them.
Dr. Mohammed Hamid of the International Medical Corps in Gaza. Finally on the programme today, a video hugely popular at the moment on the BBC News website shows the American rock star John Bon Jovi helping a distressed woman to safety after she'd got onto the ledge of a bridge in Nashville, Tennessee. He was filming a music video on the bridge at the time. He and an unnamed bystander persuaded the woman to climb back over the railings, hugged her, and walked her back to safety. My colleague Nuala McGovern has been speaking to Nikki Perfect, who's a British former police negotiator who now trains people in crisis communication. What did she think having seen the police video of that incident in Nashville?
It's a lovely video to watch, and it's very interesting. There was a couple of things that really interest me in how they approached her. You'll notice that the female puts the her whatever she has in her hands down and then moves towards the woman who is on the wrong side of the railings, or what I would call the wrong side of the railings. Mm-hmm. And Bon Jovi, he goes to the railings and just keeps a little way back. But if you watch, she turns and she can see that he's there. So he already has her attention, which is always good in a negotiation around somebody on the wrong side of the railing. So yeah, I found that fascinating.
I found his body language fascinating, John Bon Jovi's. He was so relaxed. He kind of casually leaned over as if they were just chatting about something, very humdrum every day instead of this precarious, as I described it, situation. And I was wondering, you know, for the average person, we're not equipped to deal with these situations. You obviously are. What do you think needs to come into moments like this for them to turn out well?
Yeah, and that's a lovely question, because people often say to me, you know, I don't want to get it wrong. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I'm not sure what I would do myself in that situation. And we find really that just sharing some kindness and stopping and asking somebody if they are okay is the most simple form of human connection, and is very powerful and makes a real difference, especially if somebody is in a crisis like this lady seems to be standing on that wrong side. But just saying to somebody, are you okay? Or saying what you see, like, I notice you're standing on the wrong side of the railings. You seem a bit distressed. How can I help you? Just having those words with somebody helps them to change their focus a little bit and helps them to re-engage. And perhaps might even, if they're thinking that nobody cares about me, I'm all alone in the world, that might just have a bit of a connection with them. And they go, well, actually, here's some evidence that somebody does care about me because they've stopped to talk to me.
Is that the common thread, do you think, in situations you've been in?
Definitely kindness and empathy and listening without judgment, and that don't try and solve my problem for me. Just hear me and hear what I've got to say is hugely powerful. And I've witnessed that in many cases where people have been in crisis.
The woman did touch the distressed woman briefly, which was a brave move in some ways. It worked in this instance.
Yes, it did. And that's interesting you notice that as well. I watched it and I watched her approach, and I noticed that the woman had turned to see her.
Yes.
And I think that's really key there, the fact that she was already seen, because I feel that if the lady had still been looking out and you'd have touched her, that might have made her jump a bit or made her a bit nervous.
Former UK police negotiator Nikki Perfect speaking to my colleague Nuala McGovern. And you can see that video featuring John Bon Jovi crisis averting in Nashville, Tennessee, by checking the BBC News website. That was NewsHour for a Thursday evening UK time. Thank you for listening.
Eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is know who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys, Season 2, The Disciples, and Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the global investigations podcast from the BBC.